fire took over till the end of time? Does it mean how long from the beginning of the apostate church to the end of time? And does the end of these wonders, does that mean the end of time? Or does that mean the end of some power within this dispensation? The end of the abomination of the temple, the end of the Mohammedan power, the end of the Catholic Church, the end of the binding of Satan, the end of the thousand-year reign. It's most difficult for us to see just exactly what this, it looks like such a simple question. But as we see what the answers given here are, then the question becomes more and more complex. It's not simple at all. And I heard the man clothed in linen, verse 7, which was upon the waters of the river, when he held up his right hand and his left hand unto heaven, and swear by him that liveth forever, that it shall be for a time, times and a half, and when he shall have accomplished to scatter the power of the holy people, all these things shall be finished. Now this angel, he calls him a man here, which was upon the waters of the river, he held up his right hand and his left hand unto heaven, and he sware by him that liveth forever and ever. And the source, or the subject of his oath was, that it shall be for a time, times and a half. And when he shall have accomplished to scatter the power of the holy people, all these things shall be finished. We know that this time and times and a half, as we study about it in Revelation, this is that 3.5 year period, that 42-month period, that 1260-day period, which prophetically then is a 1260-year period. Now we have pretty good evidence as to what that refers to. That refers to the beginning of the Catholic power until the decline of the Catholic power. Not the end of the world, and not the beginning of the Christian age, or not the time in which Daniel lived even. And so, unless we have a prophecy relating to a period of time that's entirely different from the one given in Revelation, that's what we have to attribute this to. And I personally see no reason why it can't be attributed to that, because nothing else seems to fit it any better or as good. There's just no date that seems to fit this any better. You start from Daniel and get 1260 years and you don't come up with any significant time. You start with Antiochus Epiphanes, and there again there's no significant time to me. So that would seem to relate to that part of it, simply because we have studied from the book of Revelation and found a very good application of that. In the 7th chapter of Daniel, the 25th verse, he speaks of this very same thing. Let me read what Mr. Clark says about that particular verse to show you why that is very likely what he's talking about. This is talking about the Roman power, the Roman Catholic power, let me say. Daniel 7, verse 25. And he shall speak great words against the Most High, and shall wear out the saints of the Most High, and think to change times and laws, and they shall be given into his hand until a time and times and the dividing of time. Now, Mr. Clark says, to none can this apply so well or so fully as to the popes of Rome. So here we have Daniel given this time and times and half a time again now. And it seems to point right to the Catholic Church. They have assumed infallibility, which belongs only to God. They profess to forgive sins, which belongs only to God. They profess to open and shut heaven, which belongs only to God. They profess to be higher than all the kings of the earth, which belongs only to God. They go beyond God in pretending to loose whole nations from their oath of allegiance to their kings when such kings do not please them. They go against God when they give indulgences for sin. This is the worst of all blasphemies. And they shall wear out the saints by wars, crusades, massacres, inquisitions, and persecutions of all kinds. What in this way have they not done against all those who have protested against their innovations and refused to submit to their idolatrous worship? witnessed the exterminating crusades published against the Waldese and Albigenses. Witnessed God and man against this bloody, persecuting, ruthless, and impure church. And they'll think to change times and laws, appointing feasts and fasts, canonizing persons whom he chooses to call saints, granting pardons and indulgences for sin, instituting new modes of worship utterly unknown to the Christian church, new articles of faith, new rules of practice, and reversing with pleasure the laws both of God and man. Now until a time and times and the dividing of times, in prophetic language a time signifies a year, and a prophetic year has a year for each day, 3 years and a half, a day standing for a year, as in chapter 9 and 24, will amount to 1,260 years if we reckon 30 days to each month as the Jews do. So he comes up with 725, meaning the 1,260 years of the Catholic Church, and like I say, I see no reason why 11 and 7 doesn't also mean the same period. In verse 8 he says, "And I heard, but I understood not. Then said I, O Lord, what shall be the end of these things?" So Daniel heard the answer to the question, but he didn't understand it. And so he asked the question again. As though if he asked another question, or he asked the question again, he'll get a more clear answer. But as the question is asked again, it again can be interpreted a different way from the first question. So when the question is asked again, he says, "O Lord, what shall be the end of these things?" And of course, let us not be too dismayed at not understanding, for Daniel had the same problem. He says, "I heard, and I understood not, but I understood not." He heard what the answer was in verse 7, but didn't understand it. And let us not be too bold in presuming that we understand it. But having studied Revelation and come up with the same answer in verse 7 of verse 25 of chapter 7 seems to say the same thing, we can say we have an advantage that Daniel didn't have. We can look back on several thousand years of history that he didn't have to look back upon to make an application. But he asked the question again, "Oh my Lord, what shall be the end of these things?" And he said, "Go thy way, Daniel, for the words are closed up and sealed to the time of the end." Now again, the time of the end, does that mean a dispensation of several hundred years or a thousand years until the end of time? Or does that mean the end itself? Verse 10, "Many shall be purified and made white and tried, but the wicked shall do wickedly, and none of the wicked shall understand, but the wise shall understand." Now this, of course, has to be talking about the time before the judgment, the time before the end of the world, before the resurrection and the judgment. And so what is he saying about it? "Many shall be purified and made white and tried." That certainly could apply to the church. In any age of the church, in any time, that can apply to it. "Many shall be purified and made white and tried." Now, they're not just made to seem to be white, they're made white. They're not just called pure, but they're made pure. They're purified. But they're also tried. "But the wicked shall do wickedly." Well, we see that being fulfilled on all hands. Regardless of how good a member of the church may be, regardless of how strong and how pure the church may be, they're still the wicked. The wicked just keep going. So he says that, "But the wicked shall do." You cannot ever expect in which the wicked are going to see wickedly. They're going to do just as sure as the fact that we exist here tonight, that the wicked will do wickedly. "And none of the wicked shall understand." Now there's another phrase that's worth memorizing and framing and applying to the very next hour that we live on this earth, and that is, none of the wicked shall understand. We cannot expect the wicked to understand what we do as Christians, nor why we do what we do, nor what the Bible teaches. They may proclaim long and loud from the housetop what they believe it teaches. They may publish all kinds of books, and they may send out those that they refer to as missionaries, and they may have those that they refer to as converts. But as long as they're wicked, they will not understand. He says, none of the wicked shall understand. Not an occasional wicked person is going to understand all this. Not a few of the wicked. Not one of the wicked. None of the wicked shall understand. Well, now who are we talking about that are wicked? We're talking about those that are not the saints. Those that are not members of the church. Those are the wicked. And those are the ones, regardless of how good of a moral life they may have, regardless of how of an education they may have, regardless of how high of a standard of living they may have, those are the ones that will not understand. And anybody who doesn't understand will not be able to please him. But the wise shall understand. Now here we can use this just as strong then in the direction that it points as we could the previous phrase, the wise shall understand. You think that you are among the wise? You think that you are among the holy and the pure and the white and those that are tried? Then you must understand. If you do not understand, then chalk up a big dark question mark by your name as to whether or not you're among the wise. Because he says the wise shall understand. Just as sure as the wicked, none of them will understand. Just as surely the wise shall understand. And so we see again how that it is emphasized over and over to us that the Christian religion and even the Jewish religion was very muchly a religion of intelligence, of rational understanding, of facts and not myths and not traditions and not blind emotional faith. The wise shall understand, but none of the wicked shall understand. So this should color our actions. Anytime we're in a group of people or even with another person that would be classified as the wicked, and we're not trying to say that they're going around with a pitchfork in their hand, wearing a suit that would characterize as that of Satan, they can be a very high moral person. They can be a very well-educated person just outside of the church. Anytime we're in their presence, we must understand one thing. They do not understand. They do not understand. And it becomes very difficult to even conduct a scriptural conversation with them many times simply because they do not understand. And as Paul was saying in our chapter in Hebrews, I'd like to teach you some things, but these words are hard to utter because you're dull of hearing. You ought to be teachers now, and I need to teach you again what to be the first principles of the faith. Or of the Word of God. So this is a part of the prophecy now, just as much as those other things are. And this part we can't understand. We can't understand. Now in verse 11. And from the time that the daily sacrifice shall be taken away, and the abomination that maketh desolation set up, there shall be 1,290 days. Now, it seems an answer to Daniel's second question. Oh, my Lord, what shall be the end of these things? Then he gives him a 1,290-day or year period. The first period was 1,260. So he's now extended 30 years onto that period. And immediately another question comes to my mind. Has he extended another 30 years onto that period? Or has he added another whole period, 1,260 years, and then another period of 1,290 years? Difficult to say. But if he's extended another 1,290-year period onto the 1,260-year period, we've still got a good ways to go before we have the judgment. But he says that it'll be from the time that the daily sacrifice shall be taken away and the abomination that maketh desolate set up. Well, this could refer back to Antiochus Epiphanes whenever he invaded the temple. It could refer to A.D. 70 whenever Titus and his Roman army invaded the temple. That could be the time that the daily sacrifice was taken away. Both of those relate to that prophecy. And then he says, in the abomination that maketh desolate set up, that could be even a period later than that time, whenever the abomination finally set in that made the whole land desolate. And as we start trying to count 1290 years from the time of Antiochus Epiphanes and the time of Titus the Roman soldier, we still have a difficult time coming up with a good period. You add 1290 years to AD 70 and you get 1360, I believe. And so I was trying to think of what happened during this time. Well, in AD 1453, Constantinople fell. That doesn't hit the date exactly. It's kind of close, but it doesn't hit it exactly. In the middle of the 15th century, which would be 1400 and something, printing was invented, the printing press, and this could be then the time whenever the desolation would be lifted as man was given enlightenment by having the Bible printed and being made available. These are all just conjectures I've had in my thoughts. I don't know that this is true at all, and many of these Mr. Clark didn't even mention. He mentions a whole set of circumstances that come up with dates of 1902 and 1947 and 1917, and they've already passed. And we know that it didn't all happen as he thought it might happen. But he's very careful to say that these dates might not be accurate. So, let me read what he says about verse 11. He says, I believe that this is a proverbial phrase, that is, that abomination that maketh desolate set up. He said he believes it's a proverbial phrase, not referring to one specific event, and may be applied to anything substituted or in the place of or set up in opposition to the ordinances of God, his worship, his truth, etc. So that it could be not only Antiochus Epiphanes, not only Titus and the Roman army, but it could also be the setting up of the Catholic popes and the bishops. It could also be the overrunning of certain areas by the Mohammedans. It could be a proverbial phrase. It refers to anything that would replace something of God. So he begins to speculate. He said Adrian's temple built in the place of God's temple at Jerusalem, the Church of St. Sophia turned into a Mohammedan mosque, etc., etc. These may be termed abominations that make desolate. Perhaps Mohammedanism may be the abomination which sprang up in A.D. 612. And if we reckon 1,290 years, verse 11, from that time it would bring us down to A.D. 1902, and which we might presume from this calculation that the religion of the false prophet would cease to prevail in the world, which from the present year, 1825, is distant only 77 years. So he came up with a date that was 77 years away, and it didn't seem to be the time. Now in verse 12, he says, blessed is he that waiteth and cometh to the 1,305 and 30 days. Now here he gives another period of time, a third period of time. Blessed is he that waiteth. Now let's stop right there for a minute. Bless he that waiteth. That's something that certainly we can do. We can remain faithful. We can be patient unto the end. We can be faithful unto death and wait for these prophecies, whichever ones of them might not have yet been fulfilled, wait for them to come to pass. That's really what God intends for us to do. Not sit back and make some dire predictions and go out and proclaim as a forecaster to the world things that is not even intended for us to understand yet, but we can wait. So he said, blessed is he that waiteth and cometh to the 1,305 and 30 days. Now that's a period of 1,335 days, which is 45 days more than the 1,290-day period. Is it an extension of that period by 45 more days? Quite possibly it is. Let's read what Mr. Clark says. This is 75 days more than what is included in the 3 years and a half, or the times and a half in the seventh verse. And as we have met with so many instances of prophetical days and years, this undoubtedly is another instance. And as a day stands for a year, this must mean a period of 1,335 years, which period is to bring all these wonders to an end that we read of in verse 6. But we are left totally in the dark relative to the time from which these 1,335 years are to be reckoned. Then he proceeds to go on into telling how it could be. And he comes up with the year 1947. But I like his phrase. We're left totally in the dark as to the time relative to when this 1,335-year period begins. It's hard to know when something's going to predict an end if you don't know when this period begins. So we're really left in quite a continuation of a mystery. We have three periods, 1,260 days, 1,290 days, and 1,335 days. And they're all in answer to the question of what shall be the time of the end of these things. Verse 12 tells us to wait. Blessed is he that waiteth and cometh to these 1,335 days. Then in the last verse, but go thou thy way till the end be, for thou shalt rest and stand in thy lot at the end of the days. Mr. Clark says about verse 12, but go thou to the end be, proper advice for every man. Number one, thou hast a walk in life, which God has assigned. Walk in way. It is thy way. So he says, go thy way. So regardless of what the prophecies mean, regardless of how little we're able to understand them, or the dangers of trying to make an application, which we know that we're on shaky ground before we ever start, we still have a way that God's given us to go. And he says, go thy way. You go the way that's been assigned you to go. There's enough in this Bible that is so plain and so outstandingly clear that applies to us, that we have a way to go. We're not left without guidance. No man has an excuse to say, well, I can't understand it. I'll just throw up my hands in disgust and forget it. You've got a way to go, and that's the last verse here. Go thy way. Secondly, there will be an end to thee of all earthly things. Death is at the door, and eternity is at hand. Go on to the end. Be faithful unto death. And that's what he says in this verse. Go thy way till the end be. There's no time to let up. No time to say I've accomplished all that God's planned for me to accomplish. I can quit. I can slack off. I can change. He says, go thy way till the end be. So you've got a way that's going to last you to the end. Whatever these prophecies show, you've got a way that'll last to the end. Then, thirdly, there is a rest provided for the people of God. Thou shalt rest thy body in the grave, thy soul in the divine favor here, and finally in paradise. And then the fourth thing, thou shalt rest and stand in thy lot at the end of the days. As in the promised land there was a lot for each of God's people, so in heaven there is a lot for thee. Do not lose it. Do not sell it. Do not let thine enemy rob thee of it. Be determined to stand in thy own lot at the end of the days. See that thou keep the faith. Die in the Lord Jesus, that thou mayest rise and reign with him to all eternity. Amen. So I think he's got a good explanation of that 13th verse. Those are words that we can understand. The words that we can apply even in the light of having a misunderstanding of the application of all of these prophecies. And so as we finish that 13th verse, we conclude our present study of this book of Daniel. Daniel has been a book that has been difficult and at the same time easy. Some of the chapters are easy. Two nights we took two chapters each night. Other times we only took portions of a chapter. So it's difficult as well as easy. Some things in it yet I make no pretense to understand. Other things seem to so clearly fit events that have happened that they certainly enlighten our understanding and broaden our concept of just what God's plan is and what is happening in this world. But yet, I think one of the most important things we can get from the study of Daniel, other than just acquainting ourselves with the book, is the fact that there are many sects who have taken this book and have developed whole doctrinal theories just out of the book of Daniel on these obscure and hard to apply passages. And like I mentioned, we could make it apply to the printing press, we could make it apply to the fall of Constantinople, we could make it apply to so many things just by twisting the dates around a little bit. Mr. Clark comes up with 1902, 1907, and 1947. Just because he was 125 years away from those times and he couldn't see them very clearly. So let us be most cautious and not let anybody come in and start overwhelming us with some kind of a theory based on the book of Daniel. There must be some plain teaching that verifies and substantiates the theory. And I think this should make us then able to withstand the onslaughts of those false teachers who will come at us, coming from Daniel to Revelation, Daniel to Revelation. You can't pin them down on anything, but they've got all kinds of theories out of the book of Daniel. And here we, not knowing anything about Daniel, stand helpless and not able to even comprehend the thing that they claim to understand plainly. So it'll give us a better foundation there. It'll add more of weaponry to our defense as we fight the Christian battle. We'll conclude at that point. Does anybody have any questions or any comments?
In Matthew 24, he's speaking about the destruction of the temple. He refers to it as the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet. Wouldn't that be this verse right here, 11?
Well, it very likely could be. Like I say, it could apply to the destruction of the temple by Titus, as Matthew 24 is talking about. It could apply to the destruction by Antiochus Epiphanes, and it could apply to some other event.
But this definitely mentions Daniel here,
though. Yeah. Well, I know that.
What verse could you use in Daniel that you could say that was it?
Well, Daniel, Daniel mentions this abomination, though, in another passage that could also apply to that. This very likely could be. This could be the very time that he's talking about. And when you add 1,290 years to that, like I said a while ago, you get the year 1,360. But also, this abomination of desolation that he speaks of in Matthew, there's good evidence to believe that that was the beginning of it, but it didn't really set in until years later, in which the Jews were completely run out of the country and the land became desolate. The land even became desolate, no longer inhabitable by the Jewish people. It's a little hard to build a doctrine on the year 1360 when it's hard to see what ended there at that particular time. It may be that, well, I don't know enough about history to know what happened then. Now, I won't argue that that's not what it is. I've been going over this chapter for about the last 2 weeks now. I thought I was going to get to it last week, and we didn't. And the more I go over it, really the less that I know. I thought I knew more about it 2 weeks ago than I know right now. Some of the things I've written down, I don't even want to mention. Because it's really folly. It's folly to do that. Mr. Clark makes this statement. He said, we're left totally in the dark relative to the time from which these 1,335 years are to be reckoned. If, however, now he goes on to speculate, if, however, we reckon from the above epoch, A.D. 612, when Mohammedanism arose, they lead us to A.D. 1947, when the fullness of the Gentiles shall be brought in, and thus a final closure of vision and prophecy be made, as then all the great events relative to the salvation of men have taken place. Wars and contention will probably then cease over the whole world. Jews and Gentiles become one fold, under one shepherd and bishop of souls, and the triune of God be properly worshipped and glorified from generation to generation over the face of the whole earth. But all these conjectures may be founded in darkness. He was right. They were founded in darkness, because we know in 1947 wars didn't end and Jews and Gentiles didn't become one. However, in 1947,